This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Trying to teach you things. Things about people, the way people are, the way you are. Hoping that you could understand better from understanding what motivates you, what makes you work. You know, it's the best thing we could do, the greatest map. You could spend all your time wishing that you want to take a trip to Burma to see the Buddha, or if you want to go to France to see what it's like down there in the south of France, or travel to Russia to see what that's like. All of these trips, but there's no journey like the journey inside your own mind. You want to discover about yourself? The place to look is inside, and that's what our program is about, understanding, getting you to understand your own mind and getting you to understand other people's mind, because understanding your mind and your mental process is like working out. It's like exercise. It's like developing yourself. It's like building muscles. It's like doing a right diet. It's like saying, how do I get my head screwed on straight? Imagine if you understood everybody and you could eventually put everybody into some kind of typology. Imagine if you could say, well, there's that type of person and that type of person and their type of person. Well, you know, you do that automatically. Everybody categorizes in some kind of way. We bring you very often stuff that is modern and current, but in this particular case, I wanted you to hear a recording that we did a while back with Don Riso and Russ Hudson. Now, Don Riso is a remarkable man who helped develop the Enneagram, E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M, a system of study that I have a lot of respect for. Don Riso is no longer with us, and this was one of his very valuable works. I'd like you to hear this. Don Riso, Russ Hudson, authors of The Wisdom of the Enneagram, and another dozen books or so, about the Enneagram, which is a typology. It's a it teaches you ways of seeing people. It's been really interesting. So we've been looking at different things with Don and Russ, taking different groupings and trying to deliver certain understandings.
Thank you, Armand. Great to be here.
Our question today is going to be about the it's about a thing that we called compliant people, but compliant is confusing. So
Right. These three types are in our books called the compliant types, but really we decided that the better word for it is dutiful. These are the dutiful people. And the idea here is that they're compliant to their superegos, that they're really superego-driven people, people who are serious, who feel that they have obligations.
They have a strong inner judge, strong inner critic. They're should and must people. What should I do? What must I do? What should
not
you
people,
do?
Now, not necessarily people who are listening to somebody else.
Right.
Right? That's a different kind of compliance.
Absolutely. They're not compliant to other people. They're compliant to this inner judge.
To this inner voice that
inner
we
voice.
Have.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. They, sometimes, of course, they might be. Mm-hmm. But it's not the feature that we're focusing on when we're looking at these personalities.
So the main feature we're looking at is a kind of self-compliance.
Right.
And by that we mean there's a strong what's called a superego.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a superego is a judge, an inner judge telling us what's right and wrong.
Right. It's that inner voice that we all learn both consciously and unconsciously from our parents and from our religion, often from our cultural values. It's really kind of a conglomeration of strictures and learned habits by which we judge the world, by which we judge ourselves, and by which we judge other people.
It's the voice that tells us what we should or should not do, and the one we believe, the one we grew up with.
Absolutely.
Would you say that guilt is a big part of that?
Absolutely, yes.
So those of you who feel like very guilty people, you want to listen in today.
Yeah.
Because guilt is a part of that thing.
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about, dutiful people. People who are, you know, there's beautiful people and there's dutiful people. I like this. I like this whole idea of being able to understand people at this level. All right, so let's look at dutiful people. Okay.
Yeah. Well, the three types that are the dutiful people are the type one, that's the reformer. Type two is the helper. And type six is the loyalist. So the one, the two, and the six on the Enneagram.
Okay, so let's go over what a one, two, and six is.
Okay.
Well, type one is probably the easiest of these personalities to understand as a dutiful person, because there's no one more serious, no one more guided by this inner judge than a type one personality, a reformer, as we call them. Mm-hmm. Ones are the people who take – they really feel they've got a mission in life. I'm here to do certain serious things. I don't have time to mess around. This is my duty, and I'm really impatient with anything that doesn't allow me to do that, that interferes with it, or that doesn't measure up to the standards that I feel are appropriate for it.
Mm-hmm.
So the good side is that, you know, these kind of folks actually do a lot of positive things in the world. They see things in long term. They're the kind of folks who are concerned about ecology early on, who get worried about political issues, social issues. But it also can get down to, you know, arguments about which way the toilet roll goes, mm-hmm. you know. And those kind of issues also take on exaggerated importance in this type of personality's mind. There is a right way to do things.
Yeah, that's really the heart of it, is that the type one feels that they know, or they should know, and shoulds and musts and oughts are going to be a big part of their mental landscape. So ones feel that they know pretty much the right way things should be done, and they're going to make it their duty, and they feel a sense of real personal obligation to always toe that line. And not only for themselves, but as they go down the levels, they have to proselytize. They have to tell other people how they should be doing things, how they should improve their lives by putting the toilet paper in the proper way, or defrosting their refrigerators in a certain way, or whatever it is.
Frequently, the older child, frequently in families, what we've learned is if it's the firstborn, mm-hmm. especially the firstborn man who has many children following,
mm-hmm.
right, that'll be the dutiful one. It'll be the one passing on the laws of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's somebody who is seeing black and white. There's mm-hmm. a good way mm-hmm. and a bad way. And mm-hmm. the good way to do it is this way mm-hmm. and the bad way is that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in the middle.
Yeah.
So consistency is a big thing. Orderliness is a big thing. Mm-hmm. You get people who are very strict with themselves, and there are no exceptions. Rules are rules, and this is what happens, you know.
These folks often have a problem with perfectionism.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people might identify perfectionistic tendencies, but nobody like a one. I mean, this is the kind of person who could write a beautiful report and totally feel crummy about it because they replaced a semicolon with a colon, you know, and I've got to redo the whole thing.
Many ministers are ones.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. By the way, I just want to backtrack, Armin. We don't think that there is any correlation between Enneagram types and birth order. So while there might be sort of an archetypal image of somebody who is firstborn being kind of like the carrier of the rules of the family and so forth, we don't see a strict correlation between those two concepts.
Not a strict, but I've done significant research in birth order,
uh-huh. mm-hmm.
and I found in certain types you'll find, like in the fourth child, you'll always find a rebel,
yeah.
and that'll kind
yeah.
of match,
yeah.
you know, that'll kind
yeah.
of match, and the firstborn tends to match. But maybe you and I will get together and we'll go over that research.
Right. That would be interesting. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the trouble with the type one is that there's not a lot of fun here. They're so dutiful. They're so serious. They feel that the obligation to perfect the world is on their shoulders so much. They've taken on the burdens of goodness and perfection on themselves so completely that they're always under the gun of their superego, and they feel guilty if they transgress in any way. Or what they're always trying to do is stay one step ahead of their superegos and try to always be better than what their superego would expect. So there's a kind of expiation. There's a kind of perfectionism to head the superego off with the pass.
I got to be so good that no one will ever find me at fault.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to go beyond. I got to do all the extra credit, you know, do the homework and the extra credit.
Yeah.
This is Armand DeMille with Don Riso and Russ Hudson, authors of The Wisdom of the Enneagram, a book that teaches about the Enneagram. It's kind of interesting. We're talking about the three types of personalities that make up what we call dutiful people. People who feel obligated. They feel like they have a duty to perform. They must do it. And I imagine if you feel so kind of stuck in that place, this must be a person who's also seething with anger.
I was just about to say that. That's interesting. Exactly. Exactly. There's a feeling, especially in type one, of resentment. That it's anger that's sort of sat on, and it's churned over, because they feel that everyone else in life is having a great time. Everyone else is just partying and doing what they want and being selfish, or, you know, giving in to their impulses. But God damn it, I'm the one who's got to be the doing all the hard work here. I'm the one who's got to be serious. I'm the one who's got to be the adult. And, yeah, that builds up this sort of reservoir of anger.
Yeah, there's this feeling of obligation mm-hmm. that, you know, it's that feeling, if I don't do it, no one else will. Or if maybe they will do it, but they're not going to do it to my students. They won't do it as well as I do. So there's always this feeling like the weight of the world is on my shoulders because everybody else is like – the feeling is other people are like irresponsible children. Mm-hmm. I'm the only adult here. Mm-hmm.
And it feels like that. You could look around you right now, probably wherever you are, maybe at your job, and you'll find a one somewhere. You'll look. It's that one person who will find that one thread that's out of place, pick it up. Decide to wipe the table, right?
The picture that's
that's a little askew. We've got to straighten that out. Yeah. And little questions that have behind it the wrath of God. They could say things like, "How did this get this way?" Mm-hmm. And you could feel this nice question, and they're doing it right.
Did you follow up what I told you to do last week?
A little intensity behind it,
yeah, exactly.
And you could feel the fury behind it. Yeah. On one hand, now. These are not always the case because dutiful people can also do wonderful contributions to society.
Absolutely.
The person that comes to mind right away is Gandhi. Gandhi was a type one, we believe. And look at what he did. What standing for the ideal is
higher
really the
principles.
Higher. Yeah, is what the one is really all about. Standing for the truth with a capital T. You know, it doesn't matter whether people like it or not, or it doesn't matter if I even like it or not. The objective higher principles are what have to be honored, and that's what the one reminds us about.
Yeah. Ones, a lot of times, have great messages, but they're not always the most effective messengers because of their anger, which people sense, and because of they seem kind of wooden, kind of stiff, and they're not – people don't feel like they can relate to them so easily. So even though a lot of times what they're saying is really on target, when they're getting more caught up in the pitfalls of this personality style, they have a lot more trouble getting their message across. They're so frustrated with people that they don't get it that they kind of turn people off.
Mm-hmm. When I see people like this, Russ, you know, sometimes they come to me for a consultation and I see them dying to have the fire in their life. These are the kind of people who will get involved with the sexual partner or relationship partner who is fiery, who's off mm-hmm. the edge, they feel like they're the earth, you know, mm-hmm. and they look mm-hmm. for fire everywhere.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They have the very often these people will be called obsessive compulsive, will they not?
That's correct. Yes.
That's right.
Right. And the obsessive compulsive has a classic relationship with what's called the hysterical borderline personality.
Yeah.
Because it's fire and it's ice. It's right. It's like I'm going to melt you. I'm going to help you be a mm-hmm. better person.
Right. That's absolutely right on, Armand. The one is in the instinctual triad, which is very interesting. Of course, that's a technical thing that people might not quite get. But the Enneagram points out that each of the types has a basis in either emotion or thinking or in the body-based. And the one is in the body-based group. But the interesting thing about one is that they're putting restraint on themselves. They're holding themselves back from feeling this kind of juicy, sexual intensity of their feelings.
They're trying to keep it under control, keep a lid on it.
Yeah.
Which is why we read about so many ministers having popped the lid, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Absolutely, because you can't keep it corked up for so long and then it's going to have its day. The whole Puritan idea of Puritanism and restraint and heaven and hell and there's only, you know, we really have to walk a fine line or else we're going to be thrown into the abyss and all that kind of stuff. Very one way of looking at things, very much a one archetype.
So we're looking at dutiful people, and we're talking about one of the types of dutiful people, mm-hmm. which is what's called a perfectionist.
Or the reformer.
The reformer. Yeah. What other names?
The teacher.
The teacher.
The educator, mm-hmm. the crusader.
Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. You get the sense of a kind of a tight restraint, self-restraint, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And that my advice to a lot of ones is to try to accept reality more, just accept what really is happening more, the facts of the situation. Because they're always, the one's mind always goes to, well, this is how it should be. Yeah, maybe it should be that way, but how about what is? Let's talk about what is first. And stress that this puts the one themselves under. The ones themselves are suffering under their own perfectionism because nobody's perfect.
Yeah,
and they know they're not perfect either, but they're trying to be.
ones tell us over and over again that they never feel that they themselves can live up to their own standards. Mm-hmm. It's just they tell us that every time they reach the standard, of course, it gets raised.
Yeah, the bar gets
you can't
raised.
Win with the inner judge.
That's an interesting point. So no matter how perfect you make it, mm-hmm. you have to make it more perfect.
Yeah.
They never stop.
And perfection is by very definition, it's impossible. It's impossible to attain. You know, if you're attaining it, then it's not perfect. It could be always improved.
I'm sorry. So it looks like someone who's always controlling thing, but in truth, this is the true slave.
Mm-hmm.
This is the absolute slave, a slave to their own superego,
mm-hmm.
a slave to this idea of what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, you find, or at least I find, the greatest sexual perversions. I mean, in the middle of that, it kind of comes out. Where does it come out?
In the low levels, absolutely. Yeah.
As a one succumbs more and more, this kind of personality style gets more caught up in this punitive, critical, harsh inner voice that's attacking the person every time they have any kind of natural desire. Well, eventually those desires become distorted. You keep it's the same. You keep an animal or a child locked in the basement long enough, it's going to get kind of strange. And
yeah.
that's essentially what happens to the one's instinctual nature. And, of course, it's not the same for everyone. For some ones, it might be something sexual. For some, it might be kind of assertive energy. There's a lot of variation with what they particularly feel is a no-no. It's what they've learned, what their culture, what their religion, what their parents have taught them
mm-hmm.
is bad or good.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever that is, this is the kind of person who says, I'm never going to go there. I'm never going to have that
and
take over me.
And it's people that we see, Russ, that the world of people looks at and says, those are the great ones.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones in control. Those are the ones who are the neatest. That if they're neat as a pin and everything is perfect, that's the ideal. And everybody thinks mm-hmm. that that's the way to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Of course, nobody could be that way, and the one who's there doesn't want to be that way.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of hiding. There's a lot of shame that's mm-hmm. in the type one. As the type one gets down the levels more, they also one of the major features that we see is depression. And usually depression is talked about in other types, like type four is known for its depression. But actually type one really does have a lot of secret depression, a kind of a heartbroken kind of emptiness that they're always against. They're fighting it constantly because a perfect person, a good person, an outstanding person doesn't get depressed. It's always functional too, you see.
Yeah, very similar to the personality type 3 that we talked about in mm-hmm. the assertive types. They,
mm-hmm.
There's a very similar pattern there.
Yeah.
I've always got to put my best foot forward.
Yeah. I want to just backtrack too and just say that I don't think type 1 is any more slave to its neuroses than any other type.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the great things about the Enneagram is that the Enneagram shows us the entire range of the personality structure from the very high-functioning, really beautiful and magnificent parts of each personality and the capacity for that person down into the depths of pathology. And as each type deteriorates, we all become slaves to something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The one becomes a slave to its superego. You're right about that. But an eight could become a slave to its lust for power and control. A two, as we'll see as we talk about in a second, could become a slave to love and to a relationship.
Well, that's our next step for sure, talking about being a slave to love.
Mm-hmm.
And as we talk about the people who are dutiful people, we talk with Don Riso and Russ Hudson, authors of The Wisdom of the Enneagram, who have done quite a bit of work with the Enneagram and more integrating the psychological. We've worked with quite a few people on this program with it, but they integrate the psychological in a way that makes it useful for me, and I hope useful for you, and goes along with this program, The Positive Mind. Let's take a look now at the second type of person who we would consider a dutiful person.
Okay.
And they certainly look it, because when I think of the Southern Belle, you know, I think of a two.
Mm-hmm.
I think of that. I say, oh, there it is right there. So let's talk about this two personality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Type two is the helper. And this is a person who feels, well, their duty is to take care of everyone,
mm-hmm.
to be the good friend, to take care of needs, to bake those cookies for the kids, to make sure that the other person's okay. Now, usually when we think of this type, we initially associate it with women, because it's sort of a role that women are expected to fulfill. And when we teach the Enneagram to people, a lot of women will initially identify as this type because they're expected to behave this way, whether that's their actual Enneagram type or not. But the particular thing here with twos is that
their superego message is that you can't be selfish.
Yeah.
You see, like for type one, the reformer, which we just talked about, you can't be wrong. You can't be imperfect. That's really the core of the superego message. For type two, it's you can't be selfish. You can't put yourself first. You can't acknowledge your own needs. Everyone else's needs have got to come before yours.
Well, that's right. They're also called the perennial giver.
The giver, yes. The caretaker.
The caretaker.
This is really the mother lover. Archetype. Huh?
And it's important. I think you make a very important point, Don. You can't recognize your own needs. You can only see the needs of others.
Mm-hmm.
I met a woman the other day who was saying to me she was taking care of a man who wasn't well. And she said, I'm looking at him every minute to see what he needs. And she says, but I'm like that. I'm always looking for what people need.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll go in a room and she'll go to a party.
Mm-hmm.
And the type one will go into a party, I guess, and say, what's wrong and what's right?
Mm-hmm.
She'll go into a party and say, what's needed?
Mm-hmm.
What need is here?
Right. Yeah.
Type one might go in and say, well, the music's too loud or this is boring. You know, the two is going to focus on people and say, what do these people need from me?
Can I help the hostess? Can I put out more hors d'oeuvres? Can I pick up clean the ashtrays?
Let me clean that up. Yes, let me do something.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's associated a lot with the whole classic codependent model, cleaning up other people's messes, taking care of that problem person in my life.
And the codependent person, the dutiful person in the form of the giver or
the helper.
The helper is in a way they're attaching people to them. They are being needed.
That's right.
Because I'm going to get you to love me or be with me by you needing me eventually. I'm going to make myself so useful.
We should call it
the useful personality.
That's exactly right. It's not a dependency on other people except covertly. It's exactly as you say. It's trying to be so useful that other people will need me and won't abandon me. So the real fear for this type of person is the fear that I'm not wanted, that I'm not loved for myself, that if I didn't do things for people, that people wouldn't want me in their lives. So the two is under this sort of superego, dutiful message from itself to always be loved, to always find ways in which I can connect with people, I can get intimate with people, I can get people to respond to me.
I wanted to say what I started to say earlier was that this, although we associate with women, just as many men are twos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's going to manifest differently. But we would say this is a very interpersonal. This is a people person.
Right.
I have to connect with people. I have to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a desire in this type to always get a kind of a positive response. Mm-hmm. Like this person's duty is to get to be kind to people, to say nice things, but to get a good response from them. I can't go through the checkout line at the grocery store without getting a little smile from the gal who's bagging my groceries.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have a first name basis with the people. I mean, there's nothing wrong with these things, but one starts to notice with the two personality that this is a compulsion. I can't stop doing it. I can't not get a smile from the gal at the checkout counter.
This is a dutiful person who looks like a dutiful person. Mm-hmm. They look compliant. They really look like I am here to serve. They look it. That I am a server, you know what I mean? I'm dutiful. I'm duty bound.
Well, yes and no. On the one hand, I think that the two is also a type that's a kind of histrionic type too, and there is also that kind of a sense of love, a sense of abundance, a sense of welcoming and of wanting to do this. And what's hidden is that kind of feeling that I've got to do this. I think they even hide that from themselves, so that there's this sort of self-persuasion that I'm just a loving person. That's just the way I am. I've got a big heart for everybody. But the fact is that unless they're being responded to in the way that they can connect with themselves, they feel unloved, and the bar rises again. The superego messages rise again. They've got to do more and more and more and be more unselfish to people until they finally get the kind of responses from people that they can feel account for love. We call this terms of endearment. Yeah. That they're always looking for that sign, that feeling, that touch that would make them feel intimate and connected with somebody else.
It's not enough that my husband or wife kisses or hugs me. They have to do it in just a certain way that I feel that they really mean it. And I will keep doing things for them until I get that particular response. Mm-hmm. But the other tricky thing with this personality is you can't ask the person directly. You can't just say, you know what, I really need a hug from you. It's got to be more like, oh, you look like you need a massage. Or, oh, you look like you need a hug. Is there anything I can do for you? Come to me.
Why can't you ask them if they're so happy to serve?
I'm saying that the two personality cannot ask the other person for what they need.
Absolutely.
Right. Even though they may be feeling, I really need a hug, it's going to come out, you need a hug.
If you could tell a two personality, go, I need you to fix my glasses, and they'll run around town getting your glasses fixed.
That's right.
And they'll run them right back. I mean, they'll do whatever they need to do.
And consciously happy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, that's where it's tricky with the dutiful thing, because they don't even see it as a duty. They see it as a privilege. They see this is great. I'm serving somebody. I love to serve. This makes me feel worthwhile. But on the back burner on their subconscious is also this anger that we talked about with type one, that there is a feeling that, gosh, people don't love me unless I'm doing things for them all the time.
They don't appreciate all the things I'm doing for them.
Yeah.
They're not certainly not reciprocating. I know your birthday. Why don't you remember mine? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And the anger that comes out every now and then
mm-hmm.
is enormous. Every now and then, I give, I give, I give, I never get.
Yes.
Right? I give, I give, I give, I never get. Now, how many people do you know that keep saying that? I'm always putting out, I'm not getting back.
Mm-hmm.
It's when it breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it breaks down, that's what happens.
That's
now,
right.
The anger can manifest how? I mean, does it get really rageful?
Well,
can
absolutely.
Be, yeah.
Yeah. The Enneagram predicts that this type would go and mimic qualities of type 8, which is to say that they become rageful, they become acting out in a lot of their anger. They can actually become physically violent, but more likely we'll see a period of kind of lambasting somebody, really telling somebody off for their own good and saying, look, let's get this straight about our relationship. Look at how much I've done for you. Why are you not responding to me? Why don't you love me? Things like that. There's a real, just a torrent of recrimination that will come out. And then, of course, what will happen is something will happen in the relationship, or the person will shut down from that and feel shameful that, oh my gosh, I feel selfish. I feel like I've exposed too much of myself.
It never becomes the one moment where they've turned around and said, I'm not going to serve no more. It's really happens that they'll burst out and then go back to serving, because that's what the codependent is like.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even if it's with another person. Mm-hmm. It might be, yeah. Even if I get to the point where I've decided as this personality, mm-hmm. I can't deal with this person anymore. They're just not appreciating me. I'll just go find someone else to serve and play the game over again mm-hmm. until I get wise to it.
Yeah.
I think also another kind of pathology that happens in the darkest aspect of this type is stalking behavior. That two, whether men or women, again, that twos tend to get love obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that they have is that they looked for people to rescue. They're real rescuers. And when you're a rescuer, you often get drawn to the very people who cannot, in some fashion, reciprocate your kindness, cannot return the love that you're giving. So this leads to more and more frustration. And then sometimes the two will help the person gets better, the person says thank you, leaves, and then the two's left kind of holding the bag.
Well, that's really interesting. Now we're getting into the exciting stuff, the primal stuff. I want to talk a little more about that as soon as we get back. We're going to take a short break. This is Armand DeMille, Don Riso, Russ Hudson. That kind of love, huh? Stalking love. We're going to talk about that as soon as we get back.
Thank you.
A little excerpt from Vicki Richards' Temple Dwellers. Vicki Richards. Talk about stalking love. Hey, we're talking with Don Riso and Russ Hudson, head of the Enneagram Institute here in New York. We're talking about a way of looking at people, and we're looking in groups. A little while ago, we did a program that was called the aggressive?
Assertive types, yes.
Assertive types, right. That was on July 3rd. Mm-hmm. That audio tape is available if you haven't heard that. It talks about the assertive type of people, the people who tend to be aggressive. And that was one grouping we looked at. Now we're looking at a thing that has been known as a compliant personality, but we're kind of renaming it to the dutiful personality. Now, here's an interesting thing you bring up, Russ. You say, but you know, that very person who could be dutiful, what was called the giver, you know, and is called the that kind of person, when they're giving all the time, giving to get, that could become the stalker. Let's go back to that, the idea of that.
Sure. Well, you get a situation, as we were saying, this type of personality, the helper, the type two, tends to keep giving and often getting frustrated, often feeling that their needs aren't being met, they're not being reciprocated. They can't ask for their needs, but they still have expectations that they will be met. Also, they tend to be drawn to people who don't respond to them. If you're looking for somebody who needs you, you end up with a needy person. You don't end up with a person who's going to be able to help you equally. You're already in an inequity. But oftentimes, what will happen, twos will keep pushing, trying to get that intimacy, trying to get that connection, trying to get that sign that the other person loves them until they actually drive the person away. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, because underneath all this, there is all this anger, all this rage, all these feelings of being rejected or that I am the one who always gets rejected. This can trigger much more problematic things, and the two may start to actually stalk a person that they feel has rejected them or is not returning their love.
If I could just add to that, it's also the fact that twos really feel unloved, as Russ is saying. And so they will fixate sometime on a person out there, could be a movie star, or it could be a rock star, it could be just somebody in their social circle, who they basically say to themselves, if I had their love, then that I'd have all I need. Then I would know that I'm good. Then I would know that I'm lovable if I had the love of that person. So they become obsessive, and it's really just another form of obsessive compulsiveness of fixating on obtaining the love of a desirable object out there.
It helps people, if they're listening closely, to understand that when somebody gives too much, back off. You know, I mean, learn that there may be something behind this, because the people who seem to give without asking for anything back, at one point they're going to say, but I brought you the tuna. Mm-hmm, Come on, how about it? Mm-hmm, you know what mm-hmm, I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like I went out and got you whatever you wanted. How about it? And that could turn into a rage, a significant rage. It could go all the way to the point of stalking. Now, I've even seen some people like this, or some people who are, and we're talking about, you know, the worst end of it, not everybody in it.
Right.
But I've seen people who believe that they're going to help you. Now they spot that somebody else is in the way. So they focus on a married man, mm-hmm. and they say, it's that woman that you're married to that's stopping you from being with me. Therefore, mm-hmm. the evil person is the woman you're with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So, and they could present a danger to your spouse.
Yeah,
that's correct. That's very true. So you see, jealousy is a big component of this. And another factor here is the undermining kind of quality. In order to, well, in your scenario, the two could undermine the qualities of the spouse in order to make the spouse less desirable to you and make themselves more desirable. Or another whole scenario is twos in a very low level, really pathological twos, can get into undermining you as a way of making sure that you don't abandon them. Once they have a connection with you and once they have a relationship, that becomes the central value in their lives, is keeping that intimacy, keeping that connection going. And if there's any hint that they get that you're drifting, you're losing interest, you don't need them, there can be a lot of manipulation and guilt instilling, kind of undermining of one's confidence in order to make sure that you stay with them.
The kind of person that might buy a bottle of wine for an alcoholic who's trying to dry out and just say, we could just have this in the house because now you're not an alcoholic anymore.
Well, that's the enabling kind of thing.
That's the kind of thing. It's just that I don't like the idea. Because the one thing, you know, you always wonder why people like to be related to drug addicts and alcohol-dependent people. The one thing about it is they're dependable.
That's right.
Yeah.
You could depend on their alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're going to be there for you. Nobody else will tolerate them. So for as long as you can keep them this way,
mm-hmm.
then they're going to be there for you. So the people who fear abandonment the most
right.
and the people who are the most dependent generally will be associated to and connected to people with drug and alcohol problems.
And that's a big part of it, yeah. It could be that. It could be learning disabilities. It could be a lot of different things, but that's a big part of it too, yeah.
Yeah, we always – when we're working with twos, we always teach them or coach them around the whole issue of recognizing and being honest right at the get-go about what their own needs are, which mm-hmm. is difficult. If you're this personality type,
mm-hmm.
it's but to start to recognize and act on your own needs, we say treat yourself the same way you would easily treat a friend.
Mm-hmm. The other part of that too is to recognize your own motivations.
Yes.
Why are you really giving? Why are you bringing that tuna sandwich? Why are you baking that cake and visiting people? You know, we all have mixed motives. Let's face it. That's part of human nature. But if you're doing it in order to get something from people, if you're doing it to make people feel guilty, or you're doing it in order to make people feel obligated to you, then there's something to question here. Because that will definitely, if you continue in that vein, that will definitely get you in big trouble with your relationships. We should say that on the positive side, type twos, when they're the helpers, are some of the most magnificent, big-hearted people in the world. You have somebody like a Mother Teresa, which is like an archetypal two of somebody who changed the world by the personification of love. She expressed unconditional love, and that's really the noble side of type two.
Yeah, I think even in a more mundane realm, twos that are healthy are just really do their best to make other people comfortable, to support other people, to recognize good qualities. But they can do that because they're taking care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sitting around sacrificing themselves for the other person, waiting for them to get the clue. Mm-hmm. They're taking care of themselves.
So the healthy twos would make excellent nurses.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Ministers also.
Mm-hmm.
All the helping professions, teachers as well. People who are, you know, have to really spend a lot of time. Therapists, yeah.
Well, not so – yeah, the healthy ones. Because
healthy
I
ones.
Know the danger of the unhealthy two, meaning the one who has a lot of needs as a therapist, and I spot them.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to get back from their patient.
Right.
The patient has to give you something back, and the need is so strong to get acknowledgement back – that, you know, you can wind up trapping that person and damaging the person.
That's
yes.
right. That's right, yeah.
Yes, it's so what we're highlighting, though, is, and it's important for people to understand when we're talking about any of these types, that there's a big difference between how they are in their healthy, high-functioning, balanced ego manifestations versus what happens when they get more caught in their stuff. It's really important for people to recognize. And we're kind of going all over the place here, talking about everything from pathology to the, mm-hmm. Some of the best qualities of these types.
But mainly we're talking about the fact that they feel duty-bound to serve.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's the main thing. That's the second type that does that.
Mm-hmm. Another person, going back in history a little bit, but she's a wonderful example, is Eleanor Roosevelt, who had self-esteem issues in terms of her attractiveness, her connection, her sexual connection with her husband. But she sublimated that in a way that was really very altruistic and was able to put her heart out to a lot of people and uplift people with her attention, her kindness, her real concern for their welfare.
Yeah, I think there are, just to say some men, I think there are a number of male twos, mm-hmm. just so that we, again, we get away from this female, mm-hmm. that all the twos are women. Leo Buscaglia was a two, the love doctor, right? His whole value system and how he expressed himself, very two. A lot of hosts of television or radio programs are often twos because they like to put the spotlight on the other
person.
They
radiate a lot of personal warmth. And also a lot of performers like Barry Manilow and Luciano Pavarotti.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not a helper, except
right,
that
very
he's
clearly.
Giving
sure.
his heart out to the whole audience, you know, enveloping everybody in his love and his the warmth that he radiates.
Armand DeMille, Don Riso, Russ Hudson. We're looking at the Enneagram and dutiful people, people who felt bound to do things in life, who are owned by their own inner, what's called the superego. We're looking at three types of people who feel duty-bound, and here is a third type now.
Type 6, and this is called the loyalist.
We've also recently found another new name called the Pathfinder, which mm-hmm. these folks seem to like.
Mm-hmm. Well, the issue here is, in terms of superego, is doing my duty, doing what's expected of me, doing what will be impactful and meaningful for the group that I'm in. There's a kind of democracy awareness in type 6 of how everyone is doing in the team. Sort of there's a consciousness of team, of family, of group mm-hmm. a wellness, you might say. Yeah.
That's particularly true. We haven't gone into this really, but there are different instincts that go with these types. That would be particularly true of the social 6. Mm-hmm. But I think the big thing with 6 feels responsible to maintain the security, the stability of whatever situation mm-hmm. this person finds themselves in. Mm-hmm. If I'm involved with a job, it's my duty to make sure that this company, it continues to function and does well. And I want to kind of make sure other people are doing their part too. If I'm in a family, you know, I feel this responsibility. But it's really, unlike the 1, the 6 personality, this loyalist, this pathfinder, is often having tremendous anxiety because, in a sense, it's more the feeling not that I'm the judge, not I'm deciding, I'm not calling the shots. It's like there are these rules and structures that exist, and I have to try to work with them and function with them. And if I do that well, then everything will be okay. The world will work. But with that also is – with a lot of 6s comes a lot of questioning of the same rules. It's like what – set of structures, what set of rules will work? What will actually get me where I want to go? What will accomplish the good thing that I want to have happen? So while 6s want to latch on to systems or beliefs or procedures that make sense to them and that they believe in, at the same time, if there's something funny about it, they can just as quickly reject it.
But these are
and
people,
rebel against
these are
it.
People who are known for their powers of doubting. I mean, they're going to question things.
They're skeptical. Mm-hmm.
All right. So, I mean, if we're going to look, because I think this is the hardest one to describe, you know, you talk about a 1 and you can see somebody straightening up lining up all the ducks. Mm-hmm. You talk about a 2 and you can see somebody with a serving tray. Mm-hmm. Right. Now you talk about a 6 and you don't really get that image. You know, mm-hmm. you may get the image of Woody Allen, for example, mm-hmm. which is one form of it, mm-hmm. you know, which has got mm-hmm. one eye kind of mm-hmm. spotting the world. But give me a picture of this personality. Give me.
I think it's the person who's trying to hold their world together and feeling like they've got to sort of scramble and scurry and put their fingers in the dikes, you know, like the little Dutch boy. And there's always problems, and I'm the one who's responsible to just keep making sure all the problems are dealt with, always covered. I know what's going to happen. I can head the problems off at the pass. Oh, my gosh, this could go wrong. And so with that orientation, there is a heightened sense of responsibility, but there is also this sense of anxiety and a sense of suspiciousness.
So you'd always – there's a general pervasive nervousness?
I think so, yeah. That's going to be one of the main features of type 6. And so the 6 is both for and against. That's what's so interesting about type 6. It's this combination of black and white, of for and against, of being dutiful and rebellious that is so interesting. And they're always flip-flopping back and forth between the two poles. So that's why it's really hard to kind of encapsulate in a word or two what the 6 is like.
And there are many variations of this.
Well,
there are more variations of this kind of personality than there are most of them. I mean, they're harder to spot as I see it.
It seems
yes.
like it. Yeah.
Yes, the pattern can show up. The pattern that defines this type can be show up in so many different ways. We're talking primarily about a person who feels very responsible to create security for themselves and the people they care about. How do you do that? What is trustworthy? What is security? For one person, it's a spouse, an intimate relationship with a spouse. For another, it's working for a big corporation. But then, oh my God, the government's going to split the company. Now what? You mm-hmm. see? So while you're looking to these different things as supports as things that will help, you know, bolster my any kind of stability in my world. And there's so many different ways a person could do that. You're always worried about things crumbling, people not being who they seem to be, getting screwed over by the boss, by the government. You know, I think these people are on my side, but what if they're not?
Mm-hmm.
And so the six is always kind of scrambling to put together the combination that will make their world work.
Mm-hmm. So trust is a big issue for six, type six.
Trust and fear, therefore.
Right, right.
The fear, so distrust is a big issue.
Yeah. Absolutely. Or ultimately in pathology, paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
So where you see paranoia very often, you'll see, you know, an extension of the six.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, there are also people who are like this, who feel so much fear that they go the other way. They could be uh-huh. the one who becomes counterphobic, isn't
right.
it?
Yes, right.
You want to describe that and see what that's like? Because I think that kind of
Well, sure. All type sixes that we've encountered have both what we're calling phobic and counterphobic tendencies. Phobic means you sort of react to and collapse into your fear. You're scared of spiders. You run away from
it's
them.
That's the
right?
Woody Allen type of six.
Right.
Yeah. But a counterphobic person, or when a six is doing a counterphobic behavior, they go against the fear. Okay, I'm scared of spiders, so I'm going to go pick one up. Or I'm afraid of heights. Let me go skydiving. Right. Mm. And we find all sixes are some mixture of the two. That there will be certain areas of life where I will feel more counterphobic, or I'll feel more empowered to be counterphobic, and some areas where I will more collapse into the fear. The thing is, even when you can't be counterphobic without phobia, you have to have a phobia to go against. And the other thing is that the counterphobic response is also a way – we haven't really talked about this, but sixes get – because they're looking to different sources, different authorities, different systems to try and work out how to live my life, how to go forward – they get confused. The church tells me this. You know, what I learned from my mom, she said this. I learned this from psychology. I learned this from those Enneagram guys. Oh, my God, which one is the true way?
So
how do I know which to go?
There's an attraction to all of these dictum mm-hmm. on one hand, and then there's this other way that says, I doubt it all anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There's another way that says, I want to follow a leader, mm-hmm. and another one that says, I hate the leader.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, it's not always that clear. I mean, what happens sometimes
sure.
with six, we'll get into a leader, and really this is why we call it the loyalist, too, is because they become the true believer, and they think, well, wow, I finally found Armin DeMille. He knows what he's talking about. I can follow him, boy. And then listens to Armin for year after year after year, and then finally says, oh, wait a second. There may be something here that I'm not quite picking up, you know. So there's a little skepticism, but there is the desire for hero worship. There is the desire for the security of finally finding somebody or something I can believe in, I can really trust. I found the grail. That's the six, is looking for that. But is also thinking in the back of their minds, but what if I'm wrong? What if I get screwed? What if somebody betrays me?
And that's relates to the counterphobia, because at a certain point, I mean, for whatever franticness sixes are doing on the outside, so running around trying to take care of different things they have to do in their lives, inside it's much more frantic. Mm. Their minds are just like hamster wheels mm-hmm. turning.
Mm-hmm.
In, with anxiety, oh, God, did I remember to turn the coffee pot off? Oh, did I pay the bill? I think I sent the rent in. Always second-guessing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the counterphobic behavior comes just because I can't stand it anymore. I just got to do something. If I think anymore, I'm just going to drive myself nuts. So just impulsively, I'm just going to do this just to get it over with.
Yeah.
I'm afraid of my boss. I've been running this conversation in my mind with him for weeks. Finally, I just go in and tell him off to just get it over with. So the worst will happen and I won't have to keep thinking about it
right.
anymore.
Right. It's interesting, too. You get all kinds of different variations of this on different levels. I'm thinking of like Tom Hanks. And who's his co-star often?
Meg Ryan.
Great sixes. There's a lovableness about them. There's a real likable kind of common man sort of quality to both those people. You could identify with them like, you know, the guy next door, the girl next door.
Yeah.
There's a spunky quality about six. Six is anxious, they're aware they're anxious, and they're working it out. They're trying to find how to live my life, how to be honest, how to be a real mensch, how to be somebody who, that's dependable. You know?
How do I belong is a real big issue.
Yeah. And you can see them tortured and tormented and kind of really putting themselves through a lot of hell to try to resolve these issues. I'm also thinking of Princess Diana. Mm-hmm. I think another good example. She had expectations, I think, about what she could expect from the royal family, and it didn't work out too well. But there was a spunkiness, a spirit, a kind of a hopefulness about the type six that was really inspiring to a lot of people.
This is Armand DeMille. We're coming to the end of our program once again. Don Richard Riso, Russ Hudson, authors of The Wisdom of the Enneagram, Enneagram. Look, the more we learn, the better off we are, huh? I hope you find this useful. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you can go to WBAI.org, or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you'll hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reactions. Be back with you soon, my friends.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you truth in radio.
It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you've always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with yourself and to be with others as well. Tune into The Positive Mind Tuesdays and most Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.